This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and not of the University of Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. Back here with on the Vanderbilt sign with JP Arroyo. So JP, when people come to the hospital, sometimes they're complaining of a bloody cough. And when we think of a bloody cough, sometimes we think about this entity called DAH, or diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. That's really not a very specific diagnosis. And I heard Caroline gave us a great presentation trying to suss through some of the differences. Can you fill me in?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Eddie. So Caroline gave us a great presentation on diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. So diffuse alveolar hemorrhage is essentially bleeding into the lungs, right? Bleeding in the alveoli. The classic presentation that we get taught is that patients get to the hospital because they're coughing blood, or hemoptysis. Actually, Caroline told us that only 25 to 30% of patients have this sort of presentation. Why is that? Well, if you think about diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, what exactly is it? It's injury or inflammation down in the lower areas of the lung, right? So the more distal areas of the lung. Inflammation or injury into the arterioles, venules, or in the alveoli themselves. That's why DAH can be associated to a laundry list of pathological processes that can affect the alveoli, the arterioles, or the venules. And that's why we can classify it into three categories: the pulmonary capillaritis, bland alveolar hemorrhage, and diffuse alveolar damage. So the classic presentation, as we said, is with hemoptysis, but that can be absent in a great deal of patients. So other things that are common are cough, fever, shortness of breath, as well as new radiographic opacities. The best way to describe them would be as peripheral sparing, right? So blood tends to stay towards the middle, sort of non-medical terms. Anemia would be very concerning because now you're having a large amount of bleeding into the lungs. And the gold standard for diagnosis is you do a bronchoalveolar lavage and you get increasingly bloody fluid. When you do the sequential washes, you're going to get more fluid. That's how you make the diagnosis of diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. Now, something that we did discuss is that with the BAL, you can identify diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, but that's not the end of the story. Now you need to figure out what's causing bleeding. And there can be a number of specific etiologies that could be causing the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. One of the more common things that we see are the pulmonary renal syndromes, right? Those are the ones that we try to think of, or we think of fairly frequently. The classic ones are the ANCA vasculitides, as well as Goodpasture syndrome or anti-GBM disease. So trying to figure out specifically what disease process is causing the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage is extremely important in terms of management, right? Because you're not going to manage all these diseases the same. Anti-GBM disease, you treat with a plasmapheresis, right? You need to remove the offending agent, add the antibody that's causing the bleeding. ANCA vasculitis, you actually treat with immunosuppression plus minus plex, but plasmapheresis is not always indicated. It's more geared towards the immunosuppression. There's also medications that could be causing the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. Crack cocaine as one of the toxic exposures that could also be causing diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. And interestingly, Caroline mentioned that the patient which she discussed had IgA nephropathy. She was wondering, the question that she asked was, is IgA nephropathy related to diffuse alveolar hemorrhage? Basically, her conclusion from the review of the literature was that in her particular patient, it wasn't, but that there can be cases of IgA nephropathy associated to diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. So to summarize, because I know we talked about a lot of minutia with diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. What is diffuse alveolar hemorrhage? Blood in the lungs. It's caused by inflammation or damage to arterioles, venules, or the alveoli themselves. It's associated with a lot of diseases as well as exposures. The key diagnosis is through bronchoalveolar lavage and progressively bloodier fluid as you withdraw fluid from the lungs. And the key to treatment is managing the underlying disease, managing whatever is causing the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. Things that we need to think about are the pulmonary renal syndromes, ANCA vasculitides, anti-GBM disease. Those are ones that are typical rule-outs whenever someone has diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, as well as infections or toxin exposures.
So JP, staying aboard the pulmonary train, when I was in med school, I was taught that the most common cause of right heart failure is left heart failure, and that's just about all I knew about it. But I heard Drew gave us a great presentation trying to suss out a little bit more of the nuances and differences of pulmonary hypertension.
Yeah, so Drew actually gave us a great talk where he reviewed all the basics of pulmonary hypertension for those of us that are not critically care inclined. Basically, let's go over the highlights of the presentation. there's five types of pulmonary hypertension. Group one, which is pulmonary arterial hypertension. This is the classic pulmonary hypertension that we talk about. Group two, secondary to left heart disease. Increased pressures on the left side that then spill over to the right, increasing the pressure. Group three, secondary to pulmonary disease or hypoxemia, which means that for some reason there's less oxygen in the alveoli, thereby increasing the resistance at the level of the alveolar capillaries. Group four, chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, or CTEPH, basically clots in the pulmonary vasculature that increase the resistance and thereby increase the pressure. And then group five, which is basically a grab bag of systemic disease, multifactorial etiologies, which is our patients that have pulmonary hypertension that we can't otherwise classify in groups one, two, three, and four. So how do you diagnose it? Generally, you start with the transthoracic echocardiogram, and that'll point you in the towards the pulmonary hypertension side when you see evidence of right ventricular overload or dysfunction. These can be a dilated right ventricle, a flattening of the ventricular septum, dilated right atrium, or a tricuspid regurg. Generally, cut off in terms of RVSP, when your RVSP, or right ventricular systolic pressure, is greater than 50 millimeters of mercury, that makes pulmonary hypertension likely. If it's less than 36, that makes pulmonary hypertension less likely. Again, I don't want to say hard cutoffs in terms of the values, but that should guide you one way or the other. What is absolutely required for the diagnosis? A right heart catheterization that actually measures the pressure gradients across the lung vasculature. Why is that important? Because you need certain criteria in order to be able to diagnose pulmonary hypertension. What are those criteria? Pulmonary hypertension requires a mean pulmonary artery pressure greater than 25 millimeters of mercury. So once the pulmonary artery pressure is high, you're going to talk about pre-capillary pulmonary hypertension or post-capillary pulmonary hypertension. So where is the pressure coming from? Pre-capillary means that the pulmonary arterial wedge pressure is less than 15 millimeters of mercury. That means that the pressure is not coming from the left side. Post-capillary pulmonary hypertension is the opposite. You're going to have a high pressure in the pulmonary artery, greater than 25 millimeters of mercury, but the wedge pressure is going to be high as well. That means that there is an increased pressure from the left side spilling over into the right side. So the classic pulmonary hypertension is the group one or pulmonary arterial hypertension, and that's the pre-capillary pulmonary hypertension, right? So that means that you have a high PA pressure with a low wedge. You have to exclude other etiologies, and you do that using PFTs, VQ scans, it's CTA to rule out CTEPH and evaluation for systemic disease. And you can classify PAH by etiology, and there can be a lot of things that cause it, right? It can be idiopathic or heritable, drugs or toxins, connective tissue disease, HIV, portal hypertension, congenital heart disease, and even schistosomiasis. He also mentioned that there was work done at Vanderbilt that identified a gene involved in familial primary pulmonary hypertension. So Dr. Jim Lloyd was a corresponding author in a paper that initially identified the bone morphogenic protein receptor 2, or BMPR2, as a gene responsible for a subset of familial pulmonary arterial hypertension. It's an autosomal dominant disease with reduced penetrance, and the BMPR2 is actually a member of the TGF-beta family. So as TGF-beta, you know, is involved in everything, but in this particular case, there was some concern that it was leading to endothelial cell proliferation. Endothelial cell proliferation is one thing, but what are the vascular mediators, or what are the hormones and signaling molecules that change how the vascular tissue in the lung is actually responding? So you're going to have a reduced expression of nitric oxide synthase, an increased expression of endothelin 1, which is a vasoconstrictor, and then you're going to have an imbalance between thromboxane and prostacyclin. So there's basically a three-hit mechanism for you to increase pressure in the pulmonary artery. This three-hit mechanism opens a door for three potential pharmacotherapy targets, right? The endothelin pathway, the nitric oxide pathway, and the prostacyclin pathway. In the endothelin pathway, common ones are going to be the endothelin receptor antagonists, bosentan, macitentan, and ambrisentan. In the prostacyclin pathway, those are going to be major IV medications like epoprostenol and treprostinil. The nitric oxide pathway involves medications that are classified under the phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors, right? Sildenafil, tadalafil, verdenafil, and the slightly different riociguat, which is basically a stimulant of the guanylate cyclase. So what are the take-home points? pulmonary hypertension as a group of diseases, and pulmonary arterial hypertension as the main group one, are basically heterogeneous diseases. So a lot of things get classified under both of these big buckets. The initial diagnostic tool, probably a transthoracic echocardiogram, which would then lead us to dig deeper through a right heart cath and trying to get those diagnostic criteria we talked about. Pulmonary arterial pressure greater than 25 millimeters of mercury, and then pre- or post-capillary, depending on whether your wedge is high or whether your wedge is low.
I heard Audrey and Gabby gave us some good presentations on a couple of diseases that we don't see all that often, but as internists are important for us to realize.
Exactly. So there's two diseases that we just need to be aware of that they're there, because one of my professors used to say, you can't diagnose something if you're not aware that it exists. Audrey talked about eosinophilic esophagitis. What is eosinophilic esophagitis? It's a chronic inflammation of the esophagus that's caused by eosinophils. That's pretty much it. It's a newer disease that sort of started to be recognized in the mid-90s. And it's thought to be caused by food allergens. And risk factors traditionally include being male, which is a 3-to-1 ratio, Caucasian, having atopy with elevated serum levels of IgE, as well as a high rate of other allergic conditions. People with asthma, seasonal rhinitis, atopic dermatitis are an increased propensity for eosinophilic esophagitis. So what are the clinical manifestations basically in children? Poor food intake. In adults, dysphagia, and basically food impaction, right? So just difficulty swallowing because the esophageal lumen is getting narrower from the esophageal eosinophil infiltration. Unfortunately, we don't know that much. There's a lot of agents in development in terms of eosinophil biology and trying to understand how the eosinophilic infiltration leads to both rigidity and narrowing of the esophageal lining. It's important to realize what the differential diagnosis is, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease, achalasia, connective tissue disorders, Crohn's that affects the upper GI, and infectious esophagitis. So what current treatments do we have for eosinophilic esophagitis? Not much, unfortunately. We have the swallowed inhaled steroids, budesonide, which some studies have shown to have complete histological remission. Dietary therapy, Audrey mentioned that there was a use of an elemental diet that can eliminate eosinophils in, 90% of children, 75% of adults. That's incredibly difficult to do. But then there was a less restrictive 6-food elimination diet, which is fairly successful, which is like a 60 to 65% success rate. And basically what you do is you eliminate the top 6 allergens, which are milk, soy, eggs, wheat, peanuts, and tree nuts, as well as seafood. And then you reintroduce them one by one and see how the patient responds. Gabby also gave a really interesting morning report on something that we don't see that much anymore, which is basically thyroid storm. So thyroid storm is actually an endocrine emergency, and it's actually pretty hard to diagnose. Thyroid storm is basically the extreme manifestation of thyroid toxicosis, right? Multi-organ dysfunction. And there is a classification that was brought up or proposed by Birch and Wartofsky in 1993 to try and standardize the diagnosis, which can still be hard. The exact mechanism through which thyroid toxicosis develops into a thyroid storm is still unknown. There's 3 basic theories: that there's a heightened response to thyroid hormones, that there's an increased availability of free thyroid hormones, and that there's an increase in adrenergic activity, which enhances the response to endogenous catecholamine. How do you make the diagnosis? Well, that's that classification scheme we talked about in the beginning. Basically, there's a scoring criteria that goes by problems with thermoregulation, central nervous system effects, GI dysfunction, cardiovascular dysfunction, CHF, atrial fibrillation, and history of precipitating event. Basically, you tally up the score. A score of greater than 45 is highly suggestive. 25 to 44 says impending storm, and less than 25 is unlikely to represent storm. What are common precipitants? A history of Graves' disease, surgery, trauma, thyroiditis, pregnancy, emotional stress, infection, MIRP, medication non-adherence. So you can see there's a laundry list of things that in patients that have thyroid toxicosis could actually tip them over into a thyroid storm. So how do you manage it? There's 4 targets of treatment. Therapies directed towards the thyroid gland, therapies directed toward the peripheral thyroid hormone, therapies directed towards systemic decompensation, and towards the precipitating factor. So against the thyroid gland, what are you going to use? PTU or methimazole? PTU is actually the preferred medication, and you give them a loading dose followed by Q4-hour dosing. Methimazole, the dose will vary, and then she also mentioned something that's not that commonly used, but it's saturated solution of potassium iodide. The preferred, as we said, the preferred method is dosing PTU. You also have to direct the therapy towards peripheral thyroid hormone conversion. Remember that as T3 gets converted to T4, that's when you have an active metabolite, and the active metabolite that is going to have the downstream effects. So you want to block those downstream effects. And how are you going to do that? You're giving them propranolol, you give them steroids, hydrocortisone, and you can even consider plasmapheresis or plasma exchange just to get those thyroid hormones out of there. And then the other two therapies, right? So the other two big targets are therapies directed toward the systemic decompensation and the precipitating factor. So supportive care, fluid resuscitation, hemodynamic monitoring, antipyretics, cooling blankets, and infectious workup, including the consideration of broad-spectrum antibiotics, even if you don't have a clear source in the beginning. The take-home point is it's an emergency, so you have to make sure that you try to recognize it early in patients that are at risk, which means patients with thyroiditis. And it's basically a diagnosis that's going to be based on recognize exaggerated signs and symptoms of thyrotoxicosis. So we just have to have that high level of clinical suspicion.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening and learning with me. Always appreciate any feedback, but until next time.